Now, this is the last week of Jesus' life, and he continues to have these interactions with the religious authorities. The one that we looked at last week were with the Sadducees, or excuse me, was with the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is a ruling council of 70 men that were comprised of three different theocratic parties, the Pharisees, the scribes, and the Sadducees. And then there was this other group that we call the Herodians, another political party. They were civil because Herod the Great had been put over Israel by Rome in, just before Jesus was born. Now, the Romans took control in their conquesting of the Israeli area there about 63 B.C. And they placed Herod on the throne a little later, somewhere around 40 or 35 B.C. So Herod gets to be king over the Jews, although the Jews hated him because he wasn't a Jew. And the Romans had somebody to delegate things to. And the Sanhedrin reported to the Romans and Herod. So the Sanhedrin are like the 70 group of men here that ran the government, the theocratic government of Israel. But they had to do what the Romans said. they were occupied and they didn't like it. So knowing that is helpful for seeing this story today. And they sent unto him certain of the Pharisees and other Herodians to catch him in his words. And when they were come, they say unto him, Master, we know that thou art true and carest for no man, for thou regardest not the person of men, but teachest the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Shall we give or shall we not give? But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, Why tempt ye me? Bring me a penny that I may see it. And they brought it, and he said unto them, Whose is this image and superscription here? And they said unto him, Caesar's. And Jesus answering said unto them, Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God. And they marveled at him. Then come unto him the Sadducees, which say there's no resurrection. And they asked him, saying, Master, Moses wrote unto us, if a man's brother die and leave his wife behind him and leave no children, that his brother should take his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. Now there were seven brethren, and the first took a wife, and dying left no seed. And the second took her and died, neither left he any seed. And the third likewise, and the seven had her and left no seed. And last of all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, when they shall rise, whose wife shall she be of them? For the seven had her to wife. Jesus answering said unto them, Do ye not therefore err, because ye know not the scriptures, neither the power of God? For when they shall rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels which are in heaven. And as touching the dead, they that rise, have you not read the book of Moses? How in the bush God spake unto him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. He therefore do err greatly, or greatly err. So let's look at this in pieces now. The Sanhedrin, who were with him in the last issue, send the Herodians and they send the Pharisees. And the text in that first verse is, And they send unto him certain of the Pharisees and the Herodians to catch him in his words. So the religious authorities, the Sanhedrin, remember I explained to you, that's that 70-member ruling council, they left him because they feared the crowd. Jesus answered their last trap. And these guys are fearing the crowd because they don't want to upset the crowd for several reasons, chief of which is that the crowds love Jesus. They saw him do the miracles, and they'd never heard somebody teaching them from the Bible. Not from all these crazy religious laws that the Jews had made up. And there were thousands of Jews that had come for the Passover from all around the Roman Empire. And thousands and thousands. I remember back a few weeks ago to the picture that I showed you of the court of the Gentiles. It was just enormous. And here's Jesus in there doing things like flipping over the tables of the money changers and screaming about the untruths that they're teaching, and they're turning this into a business instead of a house of God. And so the Sanhedrin come to him, and they didn't make any waves with him because he answered their trap so well. They went away, and they send the Pharisees and the Pharisees' enemies, the Herodians. This is incredible. You got these two people that hate each other, are diametrically opposed politically, come together in common league here to get rid of Jesus, because they both wanted to get rid of him. Said, man, we gotta come together. But they both hate each other. They both hate each other for what they do. Now, the Pharisees were super religious. Super, super, super religious. They believed in following the letter of the law. They didn't believe in the spirit of the law because they didn't know God. But, hey, you're only going to walk three steps on the Sabbath, and you better measure those steps and that kind of junk. Today we call that legalism. Got nothing to do with salvation. But, you know, you have to do this. If you dance, if you drink, if you smoke, if you you're obviously not saved. You can't do that. That's legalism, and that's what they were engaged in here. The Herodians were their political opponents. Herod's family had a lot of followers, and that was a political party. So that's who it is that's there in this particular confrontation with Jesus. These guys supported the Herods and the policies of Rome. The Pharisees did not support the policies of Rome, hated the Romans, wanted to get them out because they were occupiers, hated Herod because he pretended to be a Jew. He was a half-Jew. He was from Edom, which is today would be like southwest, at the southwest side of the base of the Dead Sea. You know, Jordan, southern Jordan in the western end. But they had this common goal. We're going to get rid of Jesus. So they came together for this common goal. And the Pharisees come to him and the Herodians, and they say, let's trap him. We'll ask him a question that he can't answer. Because no matter how he answers it, it's going to be wrong. It's like the old question of, hey, have you stopped beating your wife? What do you mean? No, I didn't. Well, wait a minute. Yes, no matter what you say, it's wrong, you know, and it's somebody trying to trap you. That's what they were doing here. Now, the Romans allowed the Sanhedrin to continue to run the day-to-day affairs. The Romans did that. They were the first imperialistic form of government. They figured, look, we'll go in and we'll conquer these regions. We'll leave a small number of soldiers here to preserve the peace. We'll implement some small government body to control the existing government. We'll let them do whatever they do. As long as they don't, in this case, kill anybody, as long as they don't have capital punishment, and they pay us money. That's all. Real simple. Keep the peace, give us money, and everything's fine. So what you have here is this logistical trap that they wanted to get him to select an authority. Who's the authority here, Jesus? God, represented by the Pharisees, sort of, or the civil government, represented by the Herodians? Because the Sanhedrin consisted of Pharisees and Sadducees and scribes, each of these groups came together in some way or another with the Herodians to try and trap Jesus. Because they were just intent upon killing him. They had to get rid of him because this guy was a massive political opponent to their way of life and what they were trying to do. Now, it's interesting is here the Greek word for catch him is a gruen. The only time it's in the New Testament is right here. And it means to violently pursue, like somebody's out hunting for food. You know, you're hungry and you got to go hunt for food. You're going to get it. So you're really going after it. And that's what they were doing here. They were trying to portray him as a false teacher so that the population would not be endeared to him. So when they finally executed him, the population would be saying, well, man, this guy's really false. You know, the ruling authorities really are telling the truth, you know, because the Pharisees feared Rome, too, because they knew if they caused an insurrection or they caused riots, Rome was going to come to them. Hey, we made you responsible and look what you're doing. They didn't want to do that. They didn't want to be in that particular spot there. Their immediate goal was to get him to say something in conflict to both religious or civil authorities so he could get arrested. That's what they wanted to do. So look what they do here now. They try and flatter him. And when they were come, they said unto him, Master. Boy, look at this. Master. He's no master to them. Ye know that thou art true and carest for no man, for thou regardest not the person of men, but teachest the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? I should have put this in a different translation because the King James here makes it really cumbersome. They approach him with flattery, and in fact they say, thou art true, which is to say, well, you're not a flatterer of anybody, Jesus. You're true. You say what, you know, is actually true. And then they go, carest for no man. What that means in the old King James there, it says, you don't curry favor with anybody. You don't kiss up to anybody, Jesus. You're not like that. You don't do these things. And it's interesting that they're doing exactly the thing to Jesus that they said he didn't do. You know, they didn't know who they were dealing with. They didn't know that this is God that knows everything, that's omniscient. He's all-powerful. He's God. He knows everything. So they follow this with additional praise. In truth, in truth. It's an interesting reversal here that the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, they are actually presenting Jesus the way he actually is. So they're trying to be hypocritical and saying, well, we know you never do these kinds of things, but they were doing them. But that's true. Jesus wasn't hypocritical. He was speaking the truth. He does teach the truth of God. So they're thinking here, well, look, we'll schmooze this guy for a little bit here, you know, and smooth everything over, and he's going to be all puffed up thinking everything's great, and then we're going to hit him with a question that he can't answer. Because no matter who he picks in this question, he's going to offend the other party. So they say, is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Taxes, that is. That's what tribute is. So is this correct to pay taxes or not? Now, a little background here is helpful. This is about 33 AD, approximately. And they've been under Roman occupation since 63 BC. It's almost 100 years. The tax they referred to was called a Roman poll tax. Everybody had to pay it. And it was one denarius, which at that time was equal to about one day's pay for an average worker. So you're paying 1/30 of your monthly pay to the Roman government. Oh, there were other monies they had to pay too. They had to pay tithes to the religious authority. So try and picture this. You got these two groups here, the civil authorities and religious authorities, and the Pharisees are trying to get him to say, along with the Herodians, pick one of us, Jesus. Who are you going to pay money to? Should you pay money to Herod here, or Caesar, they were calling him, or which didn't get stated here, but that's what they're doing. They're trying to trap him. Or he sort of paid a god here. And they didn't have to pay any Roman taxes until about 6 A.D. That's when the tax came in, and Rome made the area here, Judea, an official province. But this is a real prickly topic here, because everybody had real strong feelings about having to pay taxes to the Jews. I mean, to the Romans, excuse me. They did not want to do this. And this was still a hot political topic, even though it had been going on for 27 years or so. It was still hot, and it was still something that just really upset them. So they got this sense of obligation. They got to pay these taxes, and they have to pay tithes to the religious authorities under the Mosaic law. The Pharisees, one of the two groups that are coming to him, they wanted the tithes because they were extremely greedy and loved money. The Herodians, they wanted the Roman taxes. So you got these two groups that are coming here and say, oh, what are you going to pay, Jesus? Goes back to that same unanswerable question. Are you still beating your wife? We can't answer that at all. Is it lawful? Lawful, and they're talking about within the Mosaic law now. So is it religiously lawful to give money to those guys? They're our occupiers. Now, if Jesus said that the taxes should be paid to Caesar, then the Pharisees would say, well, you don't love God. You hate God. You're not going to feed God's temple and all the activities that we have that God put in place for you. And they were hoping that if he said that, it would turn the population against him. That's what they wanted. They wanted the people to get turned against him. So when they brought him up on charges, they wouldn't have any riots. And the Romans would be happy. The Romans, as we will see in a few weeks, didn't want to execute Jesus. But the population didn't seem to care much. If he said that he was opposed to paying taxes to Caesar, he was going to get arrested for rebellion because the population didn't want to pay taxes. And if here's this leader that is healing people and upsetting the authorities saying, no, I don't think you ought to pay taxes to Caesar. Boy, the Romans would have been after him. They would have grabbed him right then. You're starting an insurrection, Jesus. You're bringing riots here. But Jesus understood exactly what they were doing to him. He wasn't going to fall into any of these logistical traps. Everyone that they had tried to get him into, he got out of before this. And Jesus' response, well, almost 2,000 years ago, is still appropriate today. And it's helpful for believers to understand these concepts because we have to deal with secular powers all the time. So what Jesus does is he turns the question back to them. And he gives them a question to answer, just like he did before with John the Baptist. He says, where's John the Baptist from? God? Men? He turns the question around and he takes it back to them. He modifies it slightly. So they are now in the position of having to answer an unanswerable question because it's going to harm them. So he says, or they say to him, shall we give or shall we not give? But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, why tempt ye me? Bring me a penny that I may see it. And they brought it, and he saith unto them, whose is this image and superscription? And they said unto him, Caesar's. So he got this seemingly unsolvable issue here. Today we would call a issue like this, I'm on the horns of a dilemma. I don't know where that comes from, but that's a saying that people use in logic to say you got two concepts here that you need to decide between. And I don't know, I'm on the horns of a dilemma. I can't figure out which one I should choose. And the issue is, shall we give or shall we not give? So he reverses the situation And he says, somebody give me a denarius. So they get the denarius. The denarius is a Roman silver coin that was minted at that time, and it had a picture of the emperor Tiberius Caesar. Tiberius Caesar was the adopted son of Augustus Caesar, the first emperor of Rome. Now, Rome had a lot of leaders, but he was the first guy to declare himself emperor. And they made him a god because he was so wonderful. And his wife was a real slimy person named Livia. She was on the back of this thing. So Livia's on the back. Now, that's Augustus's wife. That's Tiberius's mother. And it says on the inscription, or what King James calls the superscription, Tiberius Caesar, Divi Augusti, Filius Augustus. In other words, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus. Because they had made Augustus a god. And it's interesting, you know, Augustus wanted, he thought he'd done a good job. He says to his wife, should I be made a god? I mean, I'm beginning to feel like I'm pretty godly. Yeah, we're going to make you a god. You're now divine. That's the way it works, you know, in the secular arena, you know, and you can see it today. People think that they're divine because they have gotten to some political position or they've gotten a lot of money. Somehow power will corrupt and it lets people think that they're more than they are. So there was an inscription on here called Pontifex Maximus, means high priest. And that's what in the Roman Church, what the Pope is called today, Pontifex Maximus. He has assumed this Roman title. We can go into a great deal about that another time, but I just want you to know that that has happened. And that's what the Roman popes referred to themselves as. So once Jesus gets the coin, he just says, hey, who's on this? What does it say? And they say, well, Caesar. Caesar. So Jesus says, okay, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him because he's not taking the bait. He's not answering their question. He turns it around. He gets a response to his question from them. And he makes a distinction between the responsibility to God and the responsibility to the civil government. And he's using two Greek words here in this text that we can't see. The first one is the Pharisees and the Herodians use a Greek word called didomai, and it means to give, didomai, just give. Jesus responds with a different Greek word, apodidomai. Apodidomai, it means to pay a debt. In other words, you owe this, pay it. So what he's saying, you guys are part of this country. If you really believed in God, you would see that God, because of you, placed these people over you. And you now have the responsibility to pay what you owe to the government. There's an obligation to pay taxes. I see some Christian, some far out Christian group saying, well, we don't owe taxes. So we're declaring ourselves, you know, individual churches. I'm the church of Woodheadism, and I don't have to pay taxes. So everything that I earn, I just don't pay taxes on it because I'm a church. They're crazy. Same junk that's going on here. They didn't want to pay their taxes. They could protest, but they're not going to get anything out of this by refusing to pay what's required of them. And I put several passages in the New Testament down there. The issue that we face today is the same thing, sort of, that they faced then. We have a government that is in place, supposedly to keep the peace, to run the affairs of the government, to provide for the general welfare, like an army and so on, to defend us. and we are obligated to pay taxes. You know, we're not occupied, so to speak. We have a representative form of government, and we have procedures here in the United States for redress. We can petition the government. We can establish political groups. We can do what we need to do within the system to try and back out some of the things that we feel are oppressive. They couldn't do that there, but nevertheless, the government was placed over them. See, the Pharisees on the other, see, you got the Romans and the Herodians over here being satisfied by this. Hey, this is pretty good, you know. He wants us to pay taxes, and now you got the Pharisees over here saying, yeah, but what about us? And Jesus is saying, render to God the things that are God. The Pharisees did not accept the power of God and the authority of the Scriptures, except as they would find things to give them power over the people. It says here, you got to give me, you got to, you know, instead of seeing what there is there, they refused to do that. Taxes are just a debt for the maintenance of a stable government and peace. The Romans actually brought peace and stability to that area. They didn't have it before. They may not like the Romans occupying them, but they were doing a terrible job of it on their own. So Jesus was making it really clear that his followers had a responsibility to the standing government. But what he was also saying is, you're not to worship the government. The government is an authority in civil affairs, and you have a responsibility to that entity. You're not to worship them. Those are the things of God, the deity, that is causing all this stuff to happen in one way or another, either through his causative will, making it happen, or his permissive will, allowing it to happen. We have a responsibility to God, too. You know, by the end of the first century, the Romans began to take this deity, so to speak, that they had been declaring themselves since Augustus, to be serious. Now they got really serious with this. And Domitian, the emperor, around 95 AD, he declared himself a god and that everybody was going to worship him. He took it a step farther, not just, hey, I'm a god. That's kind of cool, you know. It's, no, I am a god, and you will now worship me, nothing else. The Romans had 100 cults that they followed, you know. It was like, go to a cocktail party, and hey, what cult are you into this week? How does that one work for you? Really? Okay, that sounds cool. Maybe I'll try that one. That really, that's as crazy as it was. Along comes Christianity, and Jesus. And that really upset the Romans, because now they're looking at this and saying, ooh, man, you're changing the game here. You're talking about this like it's real. Reminds me of the time that I was asked by a woman who was going to adopt a baby and said, would you talk to me about Christianity? We're trying to pick a religion for our son. Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. So I spent 40 minutes or so talking to her in a restaurant across from where we worked, and she looked at me and says, whoa, wait, slow down, man. You're treating this like it's true. It is. Oh, no, you don't understand. We're just trying to figure out which one we like best, and we'll pick one. That's what the Romans did. They had 100 cults or more, and they were just sort of like a smorgasbord, you know. They would look at these and, oh, I heard there's a new one popping up, you know, and they'd go to the next toga party, you know, or cocktail party, and I heard they're going to bring this new one out. Really, that's exactly what they did. And what Jesus is telling them, these religious authorities, is these secular authorities had no claim on your soul. Yes, you owe them. You must pay your taxes, but they got no claim on your soul. And these guys here were not being responsible in that arena. They were not accurately teaching the Bible. They were not accurately loving the people, bringing them to God. They were doing this all in their own self-greedy interest. Because they didn't believe in the power of God. They could care less. They believed in their own power. So here's Jesus taking that crazy, unanswerable question, turning it around and exposing both of them. They failed to understand also that the one principal reason for their occupation was because they had turned away from God. And they denied his power. And so these things happen to them and they don't know why. God controls everything. God is sovereign. They were just amazed, though, at his response because they thought they could trap him. So another group now comes at him. This is just one group after another. They all hate him. None of them love God. And they got God in the flesh in their midst, and they're trying to challenge this guy. Now, the Sadducees are going to come to him, and they're going to expose themselves for what they don't believe, falsely don't believe. Then come unto him the Sadducees, which say there is no resurrection. And they asked him, saying, before I go to what they're going to say, I want to talk to you about the Sadducees here. These were what we would call today the high-end liberals, the rationalists. They denied the resurrection of the body, which is clearly taught in the Old Testament. They came from the wealthy upper class, and they largely populated the priesthood. But they were small in number, but they had managed to wiggle their way into political, powerful positions. They populated the yeshivas, which we would call seminaries. There just wasn't many of them, but boy, were they influential, because they had wiggled their way into powerful positions. You can see the same thing happening here. The liberals don't start any institutions, but they'll go in and they will deceive and lie and wiggle their way up to the top. They've done it in some of the biggest seminaries that have been in this country. Princeton, Union Theological Seminary. Yeah, I came from Presbyterianism and I know what they did there. You get into the 1890s and they had ruined those two seminaries because the liberals got in, they lied their way up the echelon, saying what they had to say to get political power. That's well documented. That's what they do. That's what they do. And once they got power, then they can radiate down to that organization their true views. And in this case here, their true views were money, give me more power. And they were denying the authority of the Bible. They didn't believe in spirit life. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in an afterlife. And they only paid attention to the first five books of the Bible. They didn't pay attention to the rest of it. Now, they occupied most of the positions on that 70-member Sanhedrin. They denied the resurrection and a future judgment. So again, it's this idea, you know, well, if I say there are no red cars, then there aren't any red cars, right? Because I said it. Well, that's what they're doing here. They deny a final judgment. They deny that there's going to be a resurrection. Well, therefore, there isn't one. I mean, we said it. We're the authorities, so, right? I mean, it's we are the people that should know. Instead of having truth, they had their own personal views, and they all liked their views because it benefited them, and they promulgated that. They were at odds with the Pharisees a lot, just like the Pharisees were at odds with the Herodians. But the Sadducees were just the super liberals. The Pharisees were the ultra, ultra, ultra right-wing conservatives. They were far out, too. Now, they were trying to trap Jesus here in this question about the afterlife and the resurrection. And they're using an example from the book of Deuteronomy, which teaches the law of love-right marriage from Deuteronomy 25. It's a well-known doctrine in the Bible. We see it in two specific spots, at least. See it in the story of the book of Ruth, where Boaz takes her to wife. He becomes the kinsman redeemer, the goel. That's part of this love-right marriage law. And we also see it in the book of Genesis, where Judah has a son that dies, and he's supposed to give his other son to this woman, Tamar. He doesn't do it, so he doesn't follow through. But the principle is there of love-right marriage. So let's look at that. They say unto him, now the Sadducees, Master, Moses wrote unto us. And again, they only pay attention, first five books of the Bible, books of Moses. If a man's brother die and leave his wife behind him and leave no children, that his brother should take his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. So these guys are mocking Jesus. And they don't believe that there's a resurrection. They don't believe there's any life after death. And they're making a very loose interpretation of this law of love-right marriage. Moses says if a husband dies leaving a male heir, his unmarried brother, without leaving a male heir. So let's say a guy dies, his wife has no children, and there isn't any, there isn't any kid to carry on the legacy, the name, the family, and more importantly, to care for this woman. In that society, if she didn't have a husband, she's destitute. She's got to go out and beg at best. She loses any inheritance, any money. She loses the land that they had. I mean, this is a horrible thing to happen in that society. So the first thing is for the brother of the man that died to marry this woman and have a child with her. And when a male heir was produced, the male heir would get the inheritance, carry on the name of the family, and the mother would be protected to keep their land and keep the money that they had. And as I said, you know, the book of Ruth and the book of Genesis talks about two incidents in pretty great detail about how that's supposed to work. But look what the Sadducees do here. They go on with the story, and it's a manufactured story. It's not genuine. Now there were seven brethren, and the first took a wife, and dying left no seed. And the second took her and died, neither left he any seed. And the third likewise, and the seven had her and left no seed. Last of all, a woman died also. Now, in the resurrection, therefore, when they shall rise, whose wife shall be of them? For the seven had her to wife. Now, there's two issues here I need to touch on. A resurrection means coming back to life in a body that is impervious to the normal conditions here. It's a heavenly body. Every one of us is going to be resurrected. Now, since the Pharisees didn't, or excuse me, the Sadducees, I keep confusing these guys. Since the Sadducees didn't believe in any of this anyway, they were confusing going to heaven and the resurrection. You go to heaven, and then someday there's a resurrection where everybody comes out of the ground, and the people that are on the earth get transformed. It comes in stages. It comes in a multiplicity of stages. Christ was the first one to be resurrected. Then the church age believers are going to be raptured and resurrected someday. The dead in Christ come out of the ground with brand new bodies that are heavenly bodies, just like Christ had. Just like Christ had. People that are here and living that are believers get transformed, according to 1 Corinthians 15:50-53. In a twinkling of an eye, you got your body. You go meet the Lord in the air. He takes everybody with him. Everybody will be resurrected. The next section of that is there are two witnesses that are going to be preaching in the middle of Jerusalem, in the middle of the Great Tribulation, and the world is going to hate them. Because think of this, all the believers leave, you're left with just sin, and this world becomes increasingly more sinful. The Antichrist is running the world government, and it gets it more corrupt. They start attacking the Jews. There's no Christians left. But people become believers. They're just not the church. They become believers during this time that didn't hear the gospel before. The three witnesses get killed. Finally, God allows them to die after they've been preaching. And the whole world hears these guys. I mean, I get this picture of CNN broadcasting this everywhere. You know, look what these guys are saying. And the world mocks them and hates them. And then God lets them die. 3 days later, and they lay there in the middle of Jerusalem. They just lay there, their bodies. 3 days, you know, boy, people start smelling real bad and looking real bad. And rigor mortis sets in and all that, you know. And after 3 days, they get resurrected. They come back to life. In the meantime, people are giving gifts to each other and partying down and thinking, man, this is great. We got rid of those ugly voices talking about this God stuff. And they go, and God lifts them up to heaven. They are resurrected and they go to heaven. Then those people who have been Old Testament saints that love God but were waiting for Christ to come and shed his blood, they will then be resurrected. And then finally, these saints that died during the Great Tribulation, they will be resurrected. And then there's a, after the 1,000-year millennial kingdom on this earth, there's the second resurrection, which is all for unbelievers that get resurrected. They get their eternal bodies, and they are resurrected to eternal punishment of varying degrees. It's not a pleasant picture for the people that have had the opportunity and refused God, just refused him. There are so many churches today that just push away the authority of the Scripture, deny it and do what we want instead of what God wants. They're not going to like where they end up. They have a sort of adherence to God, but they deny the power. They say, well, we don't do things like that anymore. We do this. We've loosened that. We do this. They'll see. They'll see what happens. So you got this resurrection these guys are talking about here. They're confusing the bodily resurrection, which is going to heaven, and they don't care anyway. They just are defying Jesus. They're taunting him. Hey, Jesus, you believe in that stuff, right? Well, here, let me give you a scenario. Tell me what happens here, huh? Tell me what happens here. So they take this hypothetical situation to an absurd level. Seven men this woman had. There is a story like this in the non-canonical book of Tobit that talks about this, and they may have been relating to that. It never made it into the Bible. There's a bunch of crazy books that have never made it into the Bible. This story in Tobit has this woman married to seven men in succession without ever having any children. But in the book of Tobit, they're not brothers. The woman in this situation that the Sadducees are describing here, we're all married to different men, according to Jewish law. There were no children produced, and they figured this question, we're going to trap him with this question, because there is no resurrection from the dead, and he's not going to be able to answer this question. Now, this question centered on the Pharisaic and the rabbinic belief that heaven's just kind of an extension of here, you know. It's no different. It's just kind of where you go and Things are a little different, but pretty much the same. They wouldn't pay attention to their own scriptures. And people do that today. They thought that, well, when you go to heaven, just, you know, you'll be married there and you know, everything's going to be more glorious somehow. But we don't know exactly, and we just deny all this stuff anyway. But the impossibility of a woman being married to seven men in heaven was given to Jesus. Because they were trying to show him that this whole thing is ridiculous anyway. Without saying it, they were trying to upstage Jesus. Try and remember now, there's thousands and thousands of people in the court of the Gentiles that came here from all over the Roman Empire for Passover. All these Jewish folks had to come back. The lack of understanding or unwillingness for the Sadducees to accept this just lets everybody know that there was no divinity. Come on, there's nothing divine going on here. You know, heaven's going to be like this. It's just, there's no different. Because they didn't believe that there was an afterlife. And if there is, well, you know, it's going to be like this. Well, come on, Jesus, give me the answer to this story about something that we don't think is true anyway. Let's make your answer so everybody here can listen and see how foolish you are. So Jesus, again, you got this horns of the dilemma type thing here. If he was either have to argue on technical grounds, say, okay, well, this one here, he died and then the brother took them, and he'd have to somehow or other, if he believed this story, would have to try and figure out within that story to unravel it to see which one is actually she was going to be married to in the resurrection. Or he's going to have to concede to the Sadducees' position that there is no resurrection, there is no afterlife, there is nothing after that. And Jesus, though, being supremely wise, being God, is not going to fall into this trap. Jesus is God, wrote the Mosaic Law. He gave it to Moses. He came from heaven. He's going to return to heaven in a resurrected body. And his answer just stuns them because they don't know most of this scripture anyway, and they don't believe it. They don't care about it. Jesus answering said unto them, "Do ye not therefore err, because you don't know the scriptures, neither the power of God. For when they shall rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels which are in heaven. And as touching the dead, that they rise, have ye not read in the book of Moses how in the bush God spake unto him, saying, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. Ye therefore do greatly err." So he, you know, it's interesting. Jesus immediately directs their attention to the essence of their questions. One, you don't know the Bible. You don't know the Bible. And you can say that today. People come up with all kinds of harebrained things. Well, now I think, yeah, that's not in the Bible. Well, yeah, I know, but I just think. Yeah, but where'd you get that? What's your basis for that? Well, I don't know. I got right to my opinion. Yeah, but it's not true. I mean, how did you change the scripture? Well, I don't know. I never look at that. That's what these guys were doing. People do that today. I think come up with these really harebrained ideas that have no basis in fact. They didn't know God. They didn't know his power. And they were denying it. So one, I don't know what God has written. I don't know God. But I think. Oh, boy, now you're in danger zone here. They didn't believe in the resurrection, even though it was taught in the scriptures. God's power makes the resurrection possible. The religious leaders were sorely lacking in knowledge. I wonder what they said when Jesus came back and walked around this earth in that resurrected body. He came back and he had a body that defied the constraints of physics in this world. It could pass through walls. It was a disaggregation of his molecules or something, where he just passed through walls. He could appear, he could disappear. They recognized him, though. They could embrace him. He could eat food, but he had a special glow, a special body. He proved to all these people that everything they denied was in fact true. And what he's going on to say here is, look, life in heaven or with the resurrected body that we're going to have when we rise from the dead is going to be similar to the angelic beings. We're not going to be angels, but we're not going to have the same constraints we do here. We're not going to need to marry. We're not going to need to propagate. We're not going to need to make more. We're not going to suffer the physical calamities that come into this world. Disease, stress, all kinds of problems that we have here. All that's done. So there's no reason for them to think about marrying in heaven. There's no death. And the believers are going to be like angels only insofar as we're going to have immortal bodies that last forever. They're not going to become angels, just like angels, similar to, have characteristics of immortality. The Sadducees just did not get it because they wouldn't believe that there's a resurrection. They wouldn't believe the Bible. They were trying to limit their understanding to those five books. And even with that, they didn't understand those really well either. Since the Sadducees accepted the first five books of the Bible, Jesus thought, I'm going to give them an example from Exodus. And let's see what they say then. Now, what we see is that they just go away. That's what they do because they can't answer them. Jesus affirms the incident of Moses' first encounter with God in the burning bush. It was an acacia bush that was burning, but it didn't get consumed. It continued to burn. We call that a Shekinah glory appearance. God is appearing in some manifestation in time and space. So I don't know if you've ever seen any of the tumbleweed type bushes that are out west. They are really dry looking things, and they sort of got flat, woody bark. And since it hardly rains in these arid climates, they will absorb water and hang onto it in a very volatile sap. And if you light that tree with a match, it just goes up like it's all gasoline. And here's Moses seeing this bush burning, but it doesn't go out. It continues to burn, continues to burn. And Moses, after being with this specific Shekinah glory, he says, well, who shall I say sent me? I mean, who are you? And he says, he is the God, present tense, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And by using the present tense here, God's saying that they're still alive. These guys didn't die. They're alive. They're with me. I got a relationship with him. And I guess the essence of this is life does not end here with death. It starts it. It transforms us into glory, which is eternal. And he concludes by the Sadducees engaging in serious error. Let's pray.